Well, on behalf of the World Affairs Council and CARE, I am Cheryl Jennings, and I am an anchor for ABC 7 News, and I am your moderator for this evening, and I feel very, very fortunate to be here with all of you tonight and with our very special guests. It is my pleasure now to introduce our distinguished guests. Since 1998, Barbara Lee has been the U.S. representative for California's 9th Congressional District. In the international arena, she has co-authored every major piece of legislation dealing with global HIV/AIDS issues since she was elected to Congress, including the legislation that created the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief and the Global Fund to Fight HIV/AIDS. TB and malaria. Now, recently, Congresswoman Lee played a critical role in raising awareness and U.S. government support for the 2010 earthquake in Haiti and the 2011 famine in the Horn of Africa. She is also a member of the Appropriations Committee and the co-chair of the Sudan Caucus. Abby Maxman is the Vice President of International Programs and Organizations for Operations for CARE, overseeing regional management and country offices in sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, Asia, the Middle East, Europe, and the Caribbean. Before coming to CARE, Ms. Maxman worked with the Peace Corps, the German Agency for Technical Cooperation, the UN World Food Program, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She has more than 20 years of experience in international humanitarian relief, development management, and working with host country counterparts at grassroots level. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Barbara Lee and Abby Maxman. Now, for the first half hour, we're going to be chatting with our guests here, and then we're going to invite you to ask your questions. We'll take your questions. So think about what you want to say. And just to let you know a little bit about me, I have been to Africa, South Africa, to deal with AIDS issues, and I went with CARE to Kosovo twice in 1999 and 2001 to report on refugees and the children of war. So I'm very, very honored to be working with both of these esteemed women tonight on these issues. And so I invite you to ask your questions a little bit later on. Abby, I want to start with you. We had you on ABC 7 today, which was great, on the 11 and the 5 o'clock news. And so I know a little bit about what is going on in the Sahel. But for the folks here, can you describe what is currently happening in West Africa in the Sahel?
Yes, and I thank you all. Thank you for being here tonight. It's wonderful to know about all the committed people interested in these somewhat neglected or forgotten issues that are happening around the world, and in the Sahel in particular. I think many of you are here because you're already aware of the issues, but as in West Africa, the Sahel is defined as the biogeographic zone between the Sahara Desert in the north and the Sudanese savannas in the south. The hardest hit countries are Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, but also the Gambia, Nigeria, Senegal are touched in some ways. CARE's own response has, the majority of our response has been focused in Chad, Niger, and Mali, where we have a presence and have worked for many decades. I think, again, many of you are aware, but the situation is a confluence of factors, or caused by a confluence of factors, failed rains, drought, the issues of climate change that affect population movements, the ability to keep in place current sustainable livelihood practices, certainly political instability, and a number of other issues and chronic poverty that people face.
Abby, could I ask you to describe what it is that your workers are seeing on the ground? It's pretty devastating.
It is, and our staff in all the countries are responding by providing emergency food assistance, working to support the food relief efforts, providing services to malnourished children and mothers most affected by the drought. Also looking into, as you're aware, the recent coup in Mali really undermined the efforts and caused other population movements cross-border, which has required us to work in more refugee camp situations, providing the emergency relief there. Concurrently, we've worked in communities over time and are trying to protect those communities who are able to sustain their assets and their livelihoods to do so, and to prevent them from falling over the edge into extreme crisis. So our efforts are on the emergency relief, life-saving side, as well as the development side, the protecting the people in the communities where we are working. And we are seeing the resilience in those communities where we have had presence to be much stronger than other areas that are affected by the drought and the situation.
One of the numbers I saw was that something like 18 million people might be affected by food insecurity or starvation and malnourishment for the children, maybe getting one meal a day, if that.
Yes, and for some time our staff have been sending the signals about people's coping strategies, moving to one meal a day for children. And I think, you know, myself as a mother, and I imagine many of you in the room, the choices people make and having to choose at times between who may get to eat in the family in a day, and it's really a very heartbreaking situation, and the need to have the attention and the resources to ensure the response and also ensure that we can prevent this situation from getting worse and prevent future cycles happening.
And I know the CARE can't do it alone, and Congresswoman Lee, I know that you have been deeply involved in this issue. You were in Africa just a few months ago.
Thank you, Cheryl. Let me take a moment also to thank the Northern California World Affairs Council for holding this forum, and also just for your tremendous leadership in bringing issues and regions of the world to our community that otherwise would not be well known, and you have continued to really lead the way. And so, Cheryl, and to Abby, thank you all both for helping to continue to educate the public and to hear from you about your ideas, because believe you me, with 18 million people, you know, whose lives are on the line, we need a lot of civic and community involvement by U.S. taxpayers. Let me just say a couple of things I'd like to mention with regard to the United States response. Overall, in terms of dollars and cents, it's been probably a total of about $338 million that the United States has allocated for this humanitarian crisis. Also, the president has authorized $10 million to be transferred from one fund to another to address this if need be. The countries most affected, and I just want to refer to my notes and let you know how much money is going to each of the countries, because I think it's important when we talk about what how much money we're investing in U.S. foreign aid. But we're talking about in Burkina Faso, $1.3 million in food assistance grants through the Catholic Relief Services. Also, this money will help establish seed voucher fares to increase community access and savings, as well as borrowing power. In Chad, and I have visited Chad not recently, but in the past, as well as the Sudan, and have witnessed the refugee crises in Chad and Sudan, and believe you me, it's enormous. But yet, we're spending about $10 million from USAID. We're providing that to the United Nations World Food Program, and this will be to purchase 7,300 tons of grain to northern Nigeria, and what we do is purchase it and then distribute it in Chad. As of June, USAID and Catholic Relief Services have provided over 60,000 food vouchers, 60,000 vouchers, and 30,000 seed vouchers to eastern Chad. So the total U.S. funding in Chad is about $4.5 million. In Mali, we're providing over $1.2 million to the Agency for Technical Cooperation and Development. Now, this will reduce the strain on some of the host communities in the capital, in Bamako. It will help families meet basic needs and distribute emergency relief items and also cash transfers. As of July, also in Mali, cholera was a rising danger. And so we have to really make sure that we're prepared to try to prevent and then respond to an outbreak of cholera. Also, we've distributed over 260 metric tons of emergency food assistance to over 16,000 refugee camps in central Mali, and we're helping to facilitate cash transfers, which is about $8 million in support. Also, $1.2 million for water and sanitation. In Mauritania, USAID-supported activities, of course, include seed distribution, emergency food assistance, cash vouchers, temporary employment opportunities, and existing malnutrition treatments on the ground, as well as access to potable water. $500,000 in funding to the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Mauritania. And finally, in Niger, aid is contributing nearly $500,000 in additional funds to existing programs that actually give cash grants to meet basic needs during the planting season, as well as offering increased access to improved seeds and agricultural techniques. And I just wanted to lay out the amount of money, because when you really break it down, it's not that much to respond to this enormous crisis. And the American people really believe that we're providing about 10% of our budget in foreign aid, when actually it's just about 1% of our foreign aid. But they actually, but the public believes, and enough polls and studies have been conducted to verify this, that the public believes we're spending 25% of our budget on foreign aid, when really it's 1%. So even if we go from 1 to where the public thinks we should be at 10%, we've got a long way to go. And believe you me, you know, as Cheryl and as Abby have said, and many of you know, that our contribution to these humanitarian crises go a long way, and we should be doing more. And America, we can afford to do more, we should do more, and we've got to really begin to look at our priorities, our funding priorities. And as an appropriator, I'm always focused on how we're going to shift our priorities to provide humanitarian assistance to these countries in the Sahel and other places, and how we begin to get our Pentagon spending under control.
One of the things that I've learned when trying to do my news stories about countries that are in dire need of humanitarian assistance is that people here, we're so blessed in this country. We have so much. Even the poorest person here has so much. They can't even imagine what it's like to not have a place to live in a hole in the ground, to not have food, to not know where your food is going to come. But it's hard for me to get people to care about that when we should care. So how do you make people understand that we need to care about other families in other parts of the world, Abby?
Well, I would say there's a number of ways at different levels. In one, it's part of our humanity. There are people suffering, there are children starving to death, and mothers and families who are incredibly resilient, living and surviving in extreme circumstances, and deserve better. There's issues of dignity and security that all humanity deserves, and thinking beyond ourselves as looking at the broader humanity. Also, just looking at those countries that are most stable and are those that have enough to eat and can move beyond subsistence to or survival to subsistence and then to sustainability. And I think if we look at the situation, the crises around the world, and a critical way of contributing to stability is by responding both to these crises, but also in the preventative parts or preventative ways. And I think lastly, when we look back at our response to the crisis in the Sahel in 2005 and did some analysis about investment, and by investing in resilience and prevention costs much, much less than when it reaches an acute stage and a real crisis. So an emergency does not have to become a disaster. And our data showed that $1 of prevention would prevent $80 of investment per person, per life, in the acute crisis phase. And so there's lots of critical reasons. And I think one other approach is just educating and awareness. I think if people are touched by the strength, the resilience of the people, that we engage with. Our staff are on the ground working tirelessly. They meet people whose stories of courage and strength and resilience are remarkable, and you can't help but be touched by that. And our efforts and the efforts of you all, everybody in the room and the World Affairs Council, are very critical to raising awareness and the importance that we are one world, and it's an interrelated and interconnected world.
Cheryl, can I respond to that? Because I think what you have demonstrated with your career in journalism and with the media really is an example of how we bring those stories to the public. Because American people, I think, are very giving people. You know, our values dictate that we respond and that we prevent humanitarian disasters. But oftentimes, we never know that this is taking place. We don't have those early warning systems for our citizens to really recognize what's taking place in the world. But when the media, for instance, in the Sudan, you know, I remember Don Cheadle, I was over there with Don, and we began to bring some media attention to what was taking place in the Sudan. And then that's when the public responded. When you look at what has happened in Haiti, I mean, an enormous outpouring of support for the Haitian people after the earthquake. But it was only after the media told those stories and presented that to the public, and then the public responded. And as Abby said, even when people don't have the privilege to go to these villages and see what's taking place, you know, once we know, we respond. I mean, I've visited Uganda with CARE and other villages and places around the world where others may not have the opportunity to travel to. But when I come back and we tell those stories and we talk about what's taking place, I've never had one individual say we should not do something. And so I think that it's more about awareness, education, and the media really helping to get the word out so that people will do the right thing, because I think Americans will do the right thing, and they've shown that in the past.
One of the things that I was telling Abby earlier today, I love what CARE does in terms of they respond to an emergency situation, but then they also give these families a way to sustain themselves and then move forward and then have lives so they can have homes, their kids can go to school. I mean, it's not just about feeding them for the moment. So if you could talk a little bit about how CARE is in it for the long haul, you really are.
Sure, thanks. I think this really speaks to the points as well, following the previous points about it's not just when the acute crisis and the immediate media attention and the media cycle, it's before and after. And CARE is on the ground, and we are working to help on the resilience and strengthening and both the before and after. And I think that's when a lot of the hard part really happens, because when there isn't the attention, we're struggling for resources to mount an appropriate response and a timely one. In the case of the current situation in the Sahel, our staff and were and early warning mechanisms were sounding the alarms months in advance to try to mobilize resources and support early. And it does help a great deal when the media cycle is there, but then the hard work is after as well. I've led major responses for CARE in Haiti, in Ethiopia, in Rwanda over the years. And the hard work after the media cycle is over, where people's recovery does require so much time and investment, and we're working with people in terms of not just the cash transfers that are so critical during the acute crisis so that people can buy grain locally and feed their families, but looking at sustainable livelihoods. And we have instituted in Niger and other places around sub-Saharan Africa and globally a village savings and loan methodology that has been highly effective and highly proven as a way to help strengthen local capacities, ability for families to have access to both savings and then resources to invest in other economic development activities that protect and promote their livelihoods and send their kids to school and enable them to have access to health services. So there's a lot of very straightforward methodologies that we are using, and it requires time and it requires organization and trust building in communities over the long haul.
And can I just comment on what Abby said and just add a little bit to what CARE is doing? Because CARE, I just have to say, is a phenomenal organization doing phenomenal work with minimal resources. Mm-hmm. I went to Uganda in April, and visited. We were looking at women's economic empowerment initiatives, HIV and AIDS, good governance, and flew up to Gulu, which is in the northern Uganda, where the war had occurred, where total devastation. But what CARE has done, not only responded to the crises, but is actually in there helping villages, helping to build villages, helping women develop their own businesses, working with healthcare providers, trying to provide family planning and assistance to men and women, and to help build sustainable villages and communities that will be stronger subsequent to the war. And it was just amazing the kind of work they're doing, even looking at how the integration of fathers and men into the overall efforts for women's empowerment and for children and families. It was just quite interesting and amazing to see the kind of work CARE is doing with minimal resources, but it can be done, but you have to plant those seeds so that these efforts can be sustained over time. And that's, I think, the challenge in terms of funding, because you just can't go there for a year and help and then leave.
Yeah, you can't just give them food, mm-hmm. because you have to get them out of it. They have to help themselves get out of
it. That's right.
And you were talking about seeds, metaphorically as well as literally. Congresswoman Lee, the programs the U.S. government is implementing to help the programs like CARE to avoid future humanitarian crises.
Well, that's important because, you know, you provide the seeds and agricultural assistance, farming assistance, then people in Africa and throughout the world will be able to feed themselves. And so what we're talking about doing and what CARE does is, you know, and this is, again, a minimum investment, helping to plant seeds, helping to ensure that food insecurity becomes a thing of the past, where people can in the future grow their own food and know how to address famine should they occur, with the early warning and having the food supplies ready to move. And so, you know, it's very important that we not only respond to the humanitarian or the immediate emergency crises, but that we provide the long-term assistance with farming, agricultural assistance, seed assistance, and everything that it takes so that people can become independent and so that these villages and these countries really can sustain themselves, because they want, you know, a thriving village and a thriving country and a thriving community. And they want to take care of themselves and their families like everybody in the world wants to.
Abby, I want to ask you about, I know that CARE particularly targets girls and women. And so I'd like you to talk a little bit about that and then how that relates to what's going on in Sahel, the Sahel region.
Yes, and I appreciate the Congresswoman's remarks about working with men and family planning and other and reproductive health arena and in all our work. So while we talk about empowering women and girls, it is not to exclude men and boys. It's based on our research, analysis, evidence in countries around the world that by investing in providing voice and choice to all members of a household, and often the most marginalized in the communities where we work are women and girls. Girls being kept home for various reasons, economic, social, a number of reasons, not having access to education. And we know that that keeps a family and a community from developing to its potential. And so our effort and focus on women's empowerment and girls' empowerment is an inclusive approach to fighting poverty, to lifting households out of poverty and communities out of poverty, and engaging men and women and girls and boys is a critical approach to that, where we're measuring the social change and transformative effects that it does have is on the focus on women and girls because of how powerful it is in so many places.
One of the statistics I read said that there's a combination of the increasing drought and a booming population contributing to problems there. So one of the questions from our audience has to do with population growth. The question is, what efforts are being made to curb population growth? I don't know who would like to take that question.
Well, of course, as a member of Congress who really is very concerned about population growth, I can't imagine why we still cannot provide for family planning through many of our programs. And I think that is key in terms of a strategy toward population control. And for political reasons, as you know, family planning, the global gag rule, you know, all of the efforts to prevent U.S. funding for family planning, those efforts have been in many countries and in many respects have been hampered. And so that, I think we all need to insist that the global gag rule and that any efforts to prevent women from engaging in family planning and men, you know, we need to have as a policy, that has to end. And I just have to tell you, I have been in many countries with, in a bipartisan delegation, where members of that, and I'm not gonna call names, but members of those delegations on the other side of the aisle would be with myself and others, and we'd go into the villages and we'd talk to mothers and fathers and families. Some have 3, 5, 6, 7, 8 children. And we said, what is it that you need to take care of your family? How are you, you know, doing this? And first thing they say is we need more help with family planning. We need more resources to teach us what to do, how to do, what the strategies are. And each time, you know, my colleagues say, yes, 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 we get it. We think that's the correct thing. And I get back to Washington, D.C., and this comes up in the Appropriations Committee, and they vote to cut those programs. And I have to challenge them and say, well, wait a minute, I was just with you. And you said you supported it, and you see the value of it. And you heard so-and-so say, look, we don't want any more than 5 kids, and we need to learn how to space our children. That was a very recent example, and you said, yes, we have to make sure that happens, and they come back and they say no.
So Abby, how does CARE deal with this?
Well, we deal with it head on, reproductive health and helping families plan and control their reproductive health in helpful, positive ways so they don't have to watch their children die over time. Families, I've run into countless mothers in Haiti, in Ethiopia, in Somalia, the list goes on, who've had to bury multiple children and often have a number of orphans because the mother dies in childbirth. Yeah. You know, they're anemic, they're giving birth time after time. If we want healthy communities, enabling and empowering women and men to be able to make, to space their children is an enormous, has enormous impact. And I have had women weeping at health centers where we have provided support to local health officials and the infrastructure needed to help provide basic family planning services, just saying, thank you, that we have an opportunity to control our health. And we've seen the children in the communities do community theater, celebrating the access to the health posts that may be able to provide these kind of services, because they know that their lives, that the families become healthier and wealthier as a result. And I have 3 children, and I have twins. And I was with a pastoralist woman in southern Ethiopia recently, and she said she was talking about her 8 children and several who have not survived, and said to me, oh, you have 3 children and you only had to give birth twice. And, how lucky you are. And it's a powerful thing, and it's an important thing, and it shouldn't be a political thing.
But if you have donors can contribute to CARE to help with population family planning, even though the U.S. government can't.
Donors can. Correct. And work with a number of donors in a number of ways to help in reproductive health, community approaches to help men and women have conversations in the household. Something in many communities where we work that's not part of the social or cultural approaches. And so just the enabling community conversations is a technique we've employed that shouldn't be a problem for any society, talking about community conversation and household conversations and getting health work, community volunteers, men and women, working together so that they can talk about and understand how to have healthier families.
Did you want to add to that?
Well, I've been everywhere in the world, and I have now run into many people who say they don't want to plan their families. They don't, and they understand population growth and population control. And they are very family-oriented and want children, but they want to know how to plan their families, and they know they want to take care of their families, and they understand climate change very well, and they understand the shrinking resources in the world. And so, you know, it's something that we all really need to address and address with from a policy congressional standpoint and politically. I mean, because, you know, this notion that we cannot support family planning efforts anywhere in the world doesn't make any sense.
All right, I want to add another question from the audience. Now, other aid contributors, what other countries other than the United States are major contributors to the Sahel, to helping in the crisis?
You know, that's a very good question. I would have to double check. I would suspect, however, that we're probably the largest donor.
I would assume so.
Yeah.
All right.
The European Union.
The European Union
is a major contributor.
Okay.
And some other bilateral governments as well.
When a country is in turmoil like this, like these countries are, the ones that you've visited, they can never get stable, which makes them prone to outside negative interests. And we saw that in Afghanistan, the poorest people being vulnerable to the Taliban's payments. So are you seeing anything like that in West Africa and the Sahel?
Well, I'll quickly just say part of the answer to the other question about the American, the public, not seeming to want to support development efforts. I think even if you find those that really don't want to, which I think is are very few, it's in our national security interest to do that. Poverty breeds terrorism, despair, you know, anger, hostility. You know, if the United States goes in and provides the type of development assistance early on in a country that's and in a village and with people who are desperate, then they become very friendly toward this country. Because, and believe you me, I've seen this all over the world, where flags are flying in places you never thought you would see a flag flying, because the United States came in and did something early on. And so I think that, you know, development assistance goes a long way in terms of ensuring the United States' national security. So if for no other reason than to increase our foreign aid budget, it should be for national security reasons.
Abby, I have a question from the audience. Providing aid can take several forms. Is it useful to promote buying from these target countries if they have any sort of economy at all? The countries that you visited, do they even have an economy? Can we buy products from those countries to help them?
Oh, can
get,
we
can
here?
We, just anybody? Or are there no economies that they don't make anything because they're just trying to survive?
Music. Well, you know, I think when we visited some of the villages, for example, in Uganda, and some of the women's micro-enterprise initiatives, some of the women there are making, and this is just a small example, but of how if we could get one of our major department stores to purchase the beads that women are making out of recycled paper. Unbelievable. I mean, these women are incredible. And these are beautiful beads, and they're made out of paper, recycled paper. And I thought when I was there, you know, if we could get a major company, a major department store to buy from these women, you know, with minimal resources, they could produce, mass produce, you know, much of what they're selling amongst themselves now. And so I think that there are really wonderful opportunities, especially in the Sahel and in Africa, even with the disaster that's taking place, to hone in on how we can help engage the entrepreneurs of those areas and begin to purchase some of their products. Because, you know, I know for a fact that, you know, you could buy in bulk some of these beads and sell them in the United States, and people would love to buy them. Women would love them and to buy these beads, and they would help the villages and the women and take care of their families. And
And I know that CARE is really big on microloans and helping small businesses start.
Absolutely, and a lot of what a byproduct of the savings and loan methodology is to help micro businesses begin and look at kind of the market linkages and value chain opportunities for those who are pastoralists and have livestock and looking at how to process and all steps of whether it's leather or dairy production. Those are types of economic developing activities we do support families to invest in. One other point I wanted to build on is beyond the products of the bead example, which is a great one, is about looking at the most efficient ways to deliver food. And with something CARE has encouraged in a lot of our analysis of food security in the food security arena is about how do we support regional and local purchase of food as a more efficient way to both in the emergency response of moving food to crisis areas for food distribution, because there's enough grain being produced, and it is the access in the regional and local purchase options and investing in enabling production locally and regionally. So whether it's in the Horn of Africa or the Sahel, there are opportunities to use foreign aid as efficiently as possible by not always moving U.S.-produced food overseas to provide the emergency aid, but investing in the future and local and regional
keeping
purchase.
Keeping the money in the
country. Or a sub-region.
In the region, right.
Sure, they're the economic entities such as ECOWAS and SADC, you know, and different regions in Africa have come together to form their economic unions so they can begin to trade amongst themselves. And I think that's really important to encourage the inter-trading among African countries through their economic unions that they have established.
We have a couple of questions from the audience relating to corruption. Isn't there a tremendous amount of corruption involved in aid to Africa? And I don't know how if CARE would see that so much, but Congresswoman Lee, you might hear about that, or Abby, you might hear about it. You want to address that?
Well, good governance, I know, was part of what we looked at with CARE in Uganda. And, you know, I believe in the last 10 years I've seen more transparency, more accountability. You can't say there's not corruption, but I see less and less of it. And, in fact, through a variety of measures that have been put into place, some, you know, may be, I think, a bit extreme. But when you look at U.S. dollars in terms of what we have been able to do abroad, I think that as long as there's transparency and accountability, that we should continue to do this. And I think that the United States has been very, very tough on corruption and, in fact, needs to really probably help countries develop better systems. Because I learned in one country that what was considered under our laws as corrupt was not considered corrupt in that country. And so, you know, there's this big disconnect, and we have to have transparency and accountability, but we also have to have technical assistance and provide some reasonable accounting and fiscal measures with countries and show countries how to, if they're going to engage with the United States government, what it takes and what the requirements are, and not just say, we're going to let you do your thing and then come back and cut the money because you didn't comply with what we wanted you to comply with, when in fact we didn't, you know, insist on certain measures being taken into account up front.
Because what happens there is a lot different than what we expect. Just yeah, the normal way of doing business.
Absolutely. It's a different countries have different cultures, different ways of doing business. And oftentimes, as I said, you know, I have witnessed this where a country, individuals in certain countries had no idea that this was a corrupt practice according to U.S. law. But now when U.S. funds are involved,
you know,
they have to know because the United States is not going to stand for any type of corrupt practices taking place with taxpayer dollars, rightfully so.
And Abby, you were on the ground. Your folks know this.
Yes, and we do a lot of approaches with communities over time, both at the during the crisis in Niger and in other. We have examples in Malawi and Ethiopia, using tools and mechanisms and teaching communities about community scorecards and how local government officials and communities work together to use mechanisms of participation, accountability, transparency, and inclusion, some principles of good governance that we build into all of our development efforts and help them have the tools so that local governments have to post budgets. And it ensures some very basic accountability mechanisms that we might take for granted. And people are very appreciative, both on the government and the community side, that these are tools and approaches of working together to hold each other accountable. I had a situation in northern Ethiopia where the regional anti-corruption agency was very grateful to CARE for working with them in helping their outreach to communities so the communities would understand and know how they can report issues of potential malfeasance. And they were so grateful. And they said, CARE's the only one who's ever worked with us to provide the resources and tools to help us be more accountable and be able to demonstrate we are. And so the appetite is really there. And we have some wonderful basic tools and that we incorporate into so many of our activities.
And, you know, that's an example of what I was saying. It's really an example of how I think USAID and U.S. assistance should be presented and as a comprehensive approach. Because, yes, we're going to provide the assistance, and we want to make sure that whatever we're doing, education, health care, economic empowerment initiatives, whatever, that a component of our aid should be that type of assistance and technical assistance and education so that to ensure the success of whatever we're doing rather than just say here and then, let's cut it because you guys did the wrong thing, you know. And I think we need to be more forthright in doing that ourselves because we're going to insist on the highest standards of good governance.
We have a number of questions from the audience about CARE's model for women's economic empowerment and how I know that you also include the men, but you particularly target women's programs. So can you explain why that is and how effective that is?
It's a great question. And why do we focus on women? I think we know that who controls the resources at the household level and where the spending happens and who is responsible for managing feeding the children and ensuring, you know, the food and water in the household. We have not only for economic development explicit purposes, but in our HIV and AIDS prevention work under PEPFAR, for example, with funding from USAID, have used those methodologies that bring women together in a way that gives them confidence. Poverty is extremely isolating, and there's women who may be in their home with no access to resources of any kind. And by coming together with like-minded community members, people in those who are HIV affected, and enabling them to save and then invest in better nutrition in the household, et cetera. You know, some of the byproducts of being able to save and then have loans, revolving loans, isn't just for the financial piece, but for the social piece and successes we've seen in virtually all our work. And it actually gives them more credibility in being able to negotiate and find agreement in the household and gives them more respect by their husbands in many, many cases. I've talked to many men's groups, women's groups, since that solidarity group approach, and the men are thrilled that the women are being able to come together to save, to invest in the household. The social constraints were inhibiting their ability to change the dynamics of how things were working. So you have the solidarity groups we have plenty of men's groups also who are engaged in the VSLA methodology, but the majority are women, and it equalizes and provides a more equal footing in how resources are invested at the household level.
Yeah, also violence against women, of course, is an issue that CARE has addressed in a very effective way. And it's been very successful because, if you're a battered woman, and if you're being brutalized all of the time, how are you going to take care of your family and take care of the village and, become economically independent and what have you? And so violence against women programs, violence reduction, helping men understand. And I remember very vividly in Gulu, in a village, a man talking about how important CARE's work was in terms of getting him to understand why he was beating his wife. And he had stopped, and he apologized, and he was, a new person as a result of
normal.
That intervention.
That was just normal.
Yeah, and he would, all the stuff, alcohol, drink, the frustration, not having a job. He could explain everything, but it was no excuse, he said.
Right.
But once CARE provided the type of support and resources, this man, again, he was a new person and a very productive male member of the family, a good husband, a good father, and the women. But it was the women's programs. It was the focus on women that actually resulted in the man being the type of man that he really wanted to be. And it was really a wonderful, and many stories like that all across Africa.
Wow. Question from the audience. Because of this continuing drought, you can't make rain, but what can you do about water and reliable distributions of clean water for the refugees and for the people in the West African Sahel region? Abby?
Well, we focus on rehabilitating water points, and doing that, not just doing the rehabilitation, but with community water management committees and ways of bringing people together so that they can, the water sources can be sustained over time, looking at better practices of water management and agriculture production. There's quite a lot we do, both in the, the beforehand, during, and aftermath in watershed management in various areas. There's a number of approaches we use, but the water rehabilitation is, in the acute crisis, one of the water point rehabilitation and delivering access to water where there is none.
It's going to be tough, because if it doesn't rain, then what are you going to do? Do you have to haul water across the country to get everybody? Is it something that the government is involved with?
Not a lot, unfortunately.
No? Okay.
Mainly, I think what I have seen in looking at new technologies for building wells, for water storage, and then, of course, in a crisis, trying to figure out how to get potable water in. But I have not seen yet a major investment in terms of how to develop and maintain clean water sources.
Okay, we have another question from the audience about U.S. agricultural subsidies. What role do they play? Do the government subsidizing agriculture here have any impact on the grains that get delivered overseas?
Yes. Ag subsidies here, if we could have some reasonable ag subsidies here, we would be able to really open up more agricultural development in Africa. And actually, it's amazing how African farmers know this. And they know the impact of farm subsidies as it relates to not being able to develop a sustainable agricultural industry in Africa. So we have to get the farm subsidies, I think, under control here in this country, because it's really undermined efforts to help develop the continent.
Abby, did you want to respond to that?
Yes, just building on that, the short answer of yes, the longer answer of an earlier question about how we can invest in local and regional purchase for more effective use of our aid dollars, and a practice that was very prevalent, I think, under U.S. ag subsidy or related to it, was the approach of monetization, whereby surplus commodities would go overseas to be sold on the market locally and bring in money to fund development assistance. And that's something that in 2005, CARE did built on quite a lot of analysis, and we stopped taking the monetized food for monetization because of we felt that, and evidence showed that it did undermine local production. And we've seen the administration also shift its stance, certainly in Ethiopia and other countries, I think in Mozambique coming up soon, stopping the practice of monetizing U.S. Commodities to fund development assistance just for far more efficient use of resources and investing in local production.
All right. Another question from the audience. China in the Sahel. China seems to be building the infrastructure in the Sahel. How is that affecting the future outlook toward help from the United States and other non-governmental organizations? I'm not familiar with this, so I can't even...
Well, China's helping build infrastructure not only in the Sahel, but everywhere in the world, especially in Africa and the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And I've thought about this a lot. And... You know, really, you know, people here in our country need to understand what this means, I think, because China has they've streamlined how they invest in especially Africa. They don't have, for instance, the IMF and the World Bank and a lot of the bureaucratic fiscal mechanisms in place that countries have to jump through. They go in, they do what they say they're going to do, and they leave. But of course, they leave with a lot of goodwill that they developed in Africa. Some problems I've heard African countries talk about, though, is that they're not employing African workers, and so they're not contributing to the African economy and to the workforce in terms of training and leaving a skilled workforce when they leave. But I think what I have seen over the years is that there has been this huge void in the Caribbean and Africa as a result of our not paying attention. And once there's this void, when we did not pay attention because we were doing other things in the world, then China saw that opportunity and came in and are helping tremendously in development needs of African nations and in the Caribbean. And so that's a fact. And I think the United States now, we have to kind of look at how we figure this out and how our country, again, I have to go back to the 25% in foreign aid that people think we're contributing and say, let's go from 1% to 10%.
Right.
We have to enhance our trade with Africa, which will allow for fair and free trade. And so there are many, many efforts that we are behind the time on that we need to catch up with. Otherwise, you're going to see countries moving in when there's this huge void that, because of whatever reason, we have not filled.
And I was at the World Economic Forum for Africa in Addis Ababa in May, and there was a lot of discussion about China's investment on the continent and what an important investment it has been, and African leaders were looking to China as a model for development and talking about that and saying, well, we understand we need to learn from the mistakes, and there were some very senior Chinese officials at the World Economic Forum as well, praising Africa for learning from the mistakes they made in terms of the environmental degradation as they were developing their country, and saying, well, we want to do it, and we want to do it in a more sustainable way without the environmental degradation and impact that China has had. And so you see it manifesting itself in many ways, that very strong relationship. And as you said, Congresswoman, it's an area where U.S. foreign assistance can and should increase for all sorts of good reasons.
Are you having any issues with religious conflict in any of these areas? Thinking about it.
In the Sahel, I'm not, you're talking about in the Sahel generally.
Did any of it contribute to the crisis? Any differences? Do they even have time to? They're doing a lot of praying, I can guarantee, for food at least.
I haven't seen religion as a factor in the Sahel.
Right. Okay.
I in other areas maybe, but not. I mean, not in the Sahel.
Are there some mistakes that CARE has made in the past that it has learned from? Over the years, I know you've been there for 30 years, something like that.
In the Sahel.
In the Sahel.
Particularly. I think we have learned from how can we mobilize response more timely and awareness more timely so that we can minimize the need for the more expensive, and I mean that in all ways, in lives lost as well as dollar terms. And ways we can incorporate early warning mechanisms, engage at the policy level and with governments to encourage more timely response. We've learned from various methodologies that, you know, are more effective than others. And we are trying to embrace and find where there are things that don't work, but then also learn that in some cases, some approaches work very well in one context and don't in other contexts. So we're very much focused on a learning agenda.
We have about 4 minutes left, so I want to, I hate to end this, but it's been so informative. Congresswoman Lee, some final thoughts on what we can do as a society, everybody in this room, what can we do tonight to make a difference?
What can we do to make a difference? I think first what the World Affairs Council is doing is and continues to make a big difference.
Yes.
Informing and educating the public, but also remembering that everything is political. And without being partisan, it is political. And that means we have to make sure that your tax dollars and the public's tax dollars go to priorities that really address humanitarian crises and long-term humanitarian concerns, and as well as development in underdeveloped countries. And those are political decisions that are made primarily in Washington. And so speaking out, you know, talking to friends and family and communities about foreign aid and the importance of foreign aid and trade, the importance of not rolling back on our HIV/AIDS initiatives, because we're at a critical turning point now where we can see an AIDS-free generation if we continue to invest our tax dollars. I think it's important that even during this very difficult economic downturn in our own country, that we not lose sight that we're part of the global family, and we have a responsibility to, yes, make sure that our domestic needs are taken care of and that everyone here in our own country has access to the American dream, but to remember that we cannot forget the least of these and those who really are part of the human family, who need the wisdom and the creativity and the resources and the support of our own country and the people in our country, because if they get that and if that is successful, then we'll have a world where we will see global peace and security, and I think that's what we all want to achieve. And so I just want to thank all of you, because I know all of you want to see that.
And Abby, final 2 minutes here.
Well, building on obviously the educating the public about the importance of foreign aid and how it's important in so many different ways. There's ways through CARE to engage in Students Rebuild. There's some information outside the CARE Action Network. And please go to our website, www.care.org, and you can learn about our work in the Sahel and globally, donate to CARE, or contribute and engage in educating the public on how we can continue to ensure the attention and the resources that are so badly needed are there. So
and
thank you all.
I would also like to invite people to let the media know that they want to hear more about these stories, because that might make a difference.
It will make a difference.
I hope so. And that is it. We are out of time. That concludes our program for this evening. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council and CARE, I ask you to join me in thanking Barbara Lee and Abby Maxman for their excellent talk and discussion. Many thanks to you. Your questions were great. Thank you so much. Have a good evening.